This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's for now it's a little bit confusing and people are really worried that what will happen.
That's VOA's Abdurrahman Dia talking about decision in the DRC to postpone Sunday's presidential election. Details next.
Also, thousands of protesters are marching in cities in Sudan today, angry over rising cost and corruption, and amid Zimbabwe's crippling economy and acute shortage of foreign currency, teachers are demanding their salaries in U.S. dollars.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
The DRC's presidential election was postponed today for a week after the Electoral Commission said it needed more time to prepare. The commission first told the candidates about an unspecified delay, blaming technical problems, a fire that destroyed thousands of voting machines last week, and an Ebola outbreak in the country's east. That sparked a protest at the University of Kinshasa, where students demanded the voting proceed. Hours later, the commission publicly announced the delay, saying the vote will be December 30th. President Joseph Kabila has said he will conduct a peaceful handover of power after 17 years. He was supposed to do that 2 years ago, but has postponed the vote twice already. Yesterday, the Kinshasa governor canceled the last 2 days of campaigning in the capital, saying he had information that rival political camps were planning a confrontation in the streets. VOA reporter Abdurrahmani Dia is in Kinshasa, and he spoke with my colleague, Paul Alexander.
It's for now, it's a little bit confusing, and people are really worried that what will happen, because already at the University of Kinshasa, we are told that the students are protesting.
Considering how Kabila has held on to power and delayed the election so long already, are there concerns that this could end up being a very long postponement?
It could, but then we have to remember that the government did not want any international help for this election, arguing that it was a matter of sovereignty. But at the same time, if you reject international help, then you should be able to do a good job at holding the election with everything being ready on time. And it doesn't look like it's the case here. So that is drawing another question from some people asking if this was the real reason for rejecting international aid, if it was probably because they just didn't want to hold the elections. So that is one of the theories out there. They knew perfectly that they could not do it by themselves because it is a huge territory and they have 40 million voters.
Now, I understand that Failu had been talking about filing a lawsuit over the early end of campaigning. This seems to sort of have overwhelmed that possibility, but do we know if he still plans to do that?
We haven't heard anything so far. He was allowed to get into his home late at night, last night. But then today we are told that he was supposed to get out of town again, try to campaign, since he was not allowed to campaign in Kinshasa. So we haven't been able to reach him. We tried. So I guess all of the headquarters are trying to assess the situation and how to respond to it.
Any idea what's next?
It's a difficult question. It will depend on how determined the people are to make sure that elections are held, and also how determined the government is to make sure that nobody comes out on the street. So it could be confrontation. It could also be some wisdom from people deciding that they don't want to die for this anymore because they have been so much trouble in the country. Well, it's an evolving situation, so things could change in a matter of minutes. And last night, actually, when the first rumors of postponement have been distilled on social media, the two officials from the Electoral Commission came out on local media and saying that everything was ready and even the ballots, everything was into all the provinces. And today we are hearing that that maybe another plane from South Africa is coming on Saturday. So they don't even have coherence in their messaging. So they're contradicting themselves in so many levels.
That was VOA journalist Abdulrahmani Dia in Kinshasa speaking with my colleague Paul Alexander.
Thousands of protesters are marching in cities in Sudan today, angry over rising costs and corruption. Reuters news agency reported that police fired tear gas at hundreds of protesters within a kilometer of presidential palace in Khartoum. Some were chanting calls for the government to fall. Demonstrations were reported in the cities of Atabar, Port Sudan, Barbar, and Nohud, among others. Many Sudanese are angry over rapidly rising prices and extreme shortages of bread, fuel, and other basic goods. Inflation has stopped 60% as the government this year cut subsidies. The economy has deteriorated over the past several years after South Sudan became independent, depriving Khartoum of much of its oil revenue.
U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton blamed the U.S. United Nations Security Council for not being able to solve the decades-long dispute between Morocco and the Polisario Front over the Western Sahara. Nevertheless, he supports a referendum of self-determination for the Sahrawi people. Samir Benes is a political analyst with a special focus on the Western Sahara. He told VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi that while Bolton is correct on the need for a different Security Council approach toward conflict resolution, he disagrees with the call for the referendum.
The United Nations, and especially the Security Council, need to reconsider their approach towards conflict resolution, and not only regarding the Western Sahara issue, but also regarding all issues on the UN agenda. The same can be said regarding the Western Sahara question. Finding a common ground on the way to reach a political solution has been very elusive so far. Even though the UN has failed for the past 27 years in applying approach of self-determination, it has still not realized urgency of moving away from the sacrosanct concept and look for a more realistic alternative.
Moroccan Foreign Minister Nasser Bourita reintroduced the Moroccan plan for autonomy, while the chief of Polisario delegation, Katri Adoua, insisted that the Sahrawi people have the right to self-determination. How could the UN envoy reconcile such maximalist positions?
I believe that it is high time that the UN moved from its fixation on the concepts of self-determination and come to terms with the fact that we can't apply to today's conflict the same approaches of the 1960s and 1970s. The UN cannot keep calling on the parties towards finding a mutually acceptable political solution while it maintains the option of self-determination on the table. The UN is fully aware that Morocco would not change its position, that independence cannot be an option. Therefore, the UN has to be more creative and more realistic. But there is a silver lining in the way the Security Council has treated the conflicts in the past 2 years. For the first time since the beginning of the political process in 2007, the Security Council has called on the parties to work towards finding a realistic, practicable, and enduring political solution. The Security Council seems also to be more amenable to Morocco's repeated calls to include Algeria fully in the political process. Resolution 2440, adopted in October, includes Algeria in the conflict. No political solution can be reached as long as Algeria does not fully partake in the political process.
Given the previous position of the U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton on the conflict, leaning towards supporting the referendum of self-determination, how would you expect the U.S. role to reach a workable solution?
Bolton is known for favoring the holding of a referendum as a way to end the Western Sahara conflict. He has made this clear in his memoir published in 2007. The main reason why the UN has failed to achieve a solution to the conflict is its obstinacy to keep the referendum among options on the table while it is aware that a referendum was not possible because of the irreconcilable positions of Morocco and Polisario on who is Sahrawi and who is eligible to take part in such a referendum. Any attempt by Bolton to revive option of the referendum would be counterproductive and would set back the political process, and it will also endanger all the efforts the UN has made in the past 11 years to move the political process toward a political solution. The U.S. administration should draw the lessons from the South Sudan precedent. Self-determination was among the main principles used by the former U.S. administration to justify support for the aspirations of South Sudan's leaders. But 7 years after the independence of this country, it has neither provided the dividends of peace and stability to its people. The country has been mired in civil war for most of its existence. The U.S. should look seriously at this, at the South Sudan example, and it should serve as a sovereign reminder that the principle of self-determination as necessarily leading to independence is neither a panacea nor a one-size-fits-all solution that can apply to all conflicts on the UN agenda, including the Western Sahara.
That was Samir Benes, a political analyst with special focus on the Western Sahara. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy.
Moroccan and Danish authorities today said there is terrorism linked to the murder of a Danish woman and a Norwegian woman in Morocco on Monday. Moroccan police have arrested four suspects in the killing of Louis Vostarger Jespersen, a 24-year-old Dane, and Maran Uland, a 28-year-old Norwegian. Their bodies were found at a popular campground in the High Atlas Mountains. Moroccan officials said at least one of the suspects had affiliations with an extremist group, although the group was not named. And Danish officials said the killings can be considered politically motivated and thus an act of terror.
Amid Zimbabwe's crippling economy and acute shortage of foreign currency, teachers are demanding their salaries in U.S. dollars. And an industrial action by junior doctors is in its third week. Reporter Kutsai Zvinovashi has details.
Dr. Mtabisi Pepe is the Secretary General of Zimbabwe Hospitals Doctors Association. He explains their action.
This is day 18. Our demands were straightforward. They were not new. We had been trying by all means to engage our employer. One of the demands was the issue of acute shortage of medicines, essential medicines and vital medicines, ill-equipped public health facilities, and the issue of poor remuneration.
As Zimbabwe's market increasingly demands dollars in cash, the doctors are like many government employees. Their income is paid electronically via the government's bond notes. They are supposed to trade on par with the US dollar, but the rate is much weaker on the black market. Senior doctors have since joined in the industrial action. Pepe says doctors are justified in their demand for US dollars.
This was out of the context that things now in the market in Zimbabwe are being charged in US dollars, and we felt that our salaries were no longer enough to even pay for rentals, for transport, things like that.
Pepe adds that the basic salary is about $329, which is worth less than $100 on the black market. Pepe says there has been little negotiations and they hear most developments in the media. Zimbabwe's finance minister, Ntuli Ncube, told journalists this week that paying salaries in US dollars is not feasible.
Government cannot pay any civil servant, anyone, in hard currency. Why? Government does not earn hard currency. Our job through the central bank is to allocate the little foreign currency that we earn to critical sectors.
Zimbabwe is a net importer and gets very little foreign currency. Most of it comes from mining and the farming sector. Recently, government announced it wants taxes in imported cars and other goods to be paid in foreign currency. Obet Masaraure with the Amalgamated Royal Teachers Union says it is only fair that civil servants should get paid in US dollars. The union's members have been walking over 200 kilometers to back their push to be paid in US dollars. The marchers have been subjected to arrest twice, including yesterday. Masara Ure says they expect to reach Harare today, where they will camp outside the Minister of Finance's office until their demands are met. Zimbabwe usually records a spike in road accidents during holidays, and the absence of basic medicine and doctors in hospitals spells a disaster on the horizon. For VOA, this is Kudzai Navashe from Harare.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 21 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. There is confusion in the DRC with candidates saying the Electoral Commission chief told them the Sunday balloting is being postponed. Thousands of protesters are marching in cities in Sudan today, angry over rising costs and corruption. And amid Zimbabwe's crippling economy and acute shortage of foreign currency, teachers are demanding their salaries in U.S. dollars. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Votes are being counted in Madagascar a day after the presidential runoff election. The French news agency AFP reports that officials released results from just 6% of polling stations today, indicating that Andry Rajoelina has the lead with 57%. His rival Marc Ravalomanana had 43%. Election officials say final results should be announced after December 25th. Rajoelina and Ravalomanana were the top vote-getters in November's first round. Since neither received more than 50%, a runoff was required. Ravalomanana was president of the impoverished Indian island nation from 2002 to 2009. He was forced out of office by street protests led by Rajoelina, who was then mayor of the capital, Antananarivo. The army installed Rajoelina as president and he governed until 2014.
A group of environmental activists have condemned a recent directive by Kenya's president Uhuru Kenyatta for officials to consider allowing the use of genetically modified crops. The activists, including representatives from Greenpeace and the Africa Biodiversity Network, say the move poses a threat to smallhold farmers. From Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
In October, Kenyatta directed the ministers of Health, Agriculture and Trade to develop a quick mechanism to revive the production of cotton, including the possibility of farming transgenic cotton varieties. Campaigners opposed to the move are sounding alarm. Karen Nekesa is the regional program coordinator at the African Biodiversity Network.
Cases like Burkina Faso and South Africa, BT cotton has failed. So why does our government want to give us BT cotton in this country? Yet we know there are problems that are related to health and environmental issues. We call upon the government of Kenya to involve the communities or the farmers in public participation. So let's see the public participation issues and proper research in order for us to understand.
BT cotton is a genetically modified pest-resistant crop variety designed to combat bollworm, a serious pest that attacks cotton. According to the lobby groups, the latest move is an attempt by the authorities to introduce GMOs into the country, despite calls against the adoption of GM crops. Rini Olende is Greenpeace Africa's senior Food for Life campaigner.
Our problem today is not one of producing more food, but producing food where it is most needed and in a way that respects nature and human rights. GMO foods are being pushed as a solution for food security when research has shown that Kenya is actually able to feed itself without GMOs. Industrial corporations will benefit by proliferating GMOs in Kenya, yet we can actually feed our nation without GMOs.
Lavi Mololo, the chairman of a group of small older farmers, says they are concerned about the safety of their indigenous seeds.
Our concerns as small-scale farmers at the grassroots is first regarding seeds, because GMOs is all about seeds. We are worried that there's a likelihood of us losing our indigenous seeds with the introduction of genetically modified varieties. We also worried about loss of our livelihood, because small-scale farmers in Kenya, in East Africa and Africa generally, we do farming as a livelihood.
In 2013, the Kenyan government, through the Ministry of Health, set up a task force to assess the safety of genetically modified foods, as well as the country's readiness for the adoption of GMOs. Anne Miner from the Kenya Biodiversity Coalition says the findings of the task force have not been made available to the public.
The report was completed in 2014, but nearly 5 years later, it has not been released to the public despite numerous requests by the Kenya Biodiversity Coalition lawyers. We have reason to believe that the Professor Kihumbu Thairo report is against the adoption of GM foods and that its release is being stalled.
However, proponents say the adoption of science will boost cotton production to ensure there is enough raw material to support Kenya's textile industry. Margaret Karembu is the director of the International Service for the Acquisition of Agri-Biotech Applications, or ISAAA, a not-for-profit organization that promotes agricultural biotechnology and biosafety.
I think this is a development, this is a technology whose time has come, given that it has been in the marketplace for over 17 years now. We are now currently talking about 170 million hectares of GM crops being grown globally, and this is being grown by about 17 million farmers who are distributed all over the world from both developed and developing countries.
Kenya's domestic cotton industry has plummeted over the years, mainly due to collapse of cotton mills and increased influx of second-hand clothes imported from China and the Middle East. Ruben Choma, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kelvin Fowler, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.